Okay, so this is a recap of where we left our formal discussions last class. We have a postulate describing measurement. Here I've used the word described instead of represented just because there's no distinction to be made there. So I just want to use the same word I used for the postulate one. And so we're going to describe our measurements in terms of a self-adjoint operator with this spectral decomposition. And then the set of observable outcomes is the set of eigenvalues. And the probability of getting that outcome in any given repetition of the experiment when you have a preparation rho is the Born rule. Last class, I emphasized for you the distinction between the expectation value, which is what's often discussed in introductory textbooks, and the explicit probabilities of the Born rule, which is a more primitive way to describe things. And by primitive, I mean more fundamental, in the sense that there's more information there. Let me just give you a simple example of what the measurement device inside the box might look like. So I mentioned the operational picture last time. Which we had our preparation box. And our measurement box, they both have knobs where you select the preparation and select the measurement. And the measurement box has a readout with a pointer. And here this is the labeled by L. And it has a light that goes off, say, to let you know that an outcome has been observed. And we also put a reset button on there, which puts the pointer in its ready position. This is the go button. Okay, great. So now, what's an example of what this measurement might be? So let's look at the simplest case, which is a spin half of an electron. Okay, then what's happening inside this box is we're actually physically preparing some, well, it wouldn't have to be an electron, it could be a cesium atom, anything that's spin half. And then it's going to be actually have a physical momentum that's going to shoot it out of this oven, and it's going to enter into our measurement device. So let's look inside the box about how we would measure spin. So here, the electron comes in, and what we're going to do is we're going to put a Stern-Gerlach magnet. So what this does is creates a magnetic field gradient. Okay, I don't know which of these is north and south. You guys can, is that the right? Okay, this is correct up to an interchange of the labels. And what this does is this is described by a Hamiltonian, which is what it's going to do is it's going to couple the, in this case, let's say Sn, of the electron, this is the spin of the electron, to some magnetic field gradient. Okay, so this is an operator satisfying Sx, Xy. Here S is defined as Sx, Sy, Sz.
sure you all know what spin half is, but let me just, and then we have something like, what is it, I r over 2 SZ, is that correct? And cyclic permutations. The effect of the gradient is this Hamiltonian, this is a proportionality symbol, this Hamiltonian induces a momentum kick to the electron, so it goes up or down. So here, relative to this axis. So we'll call this axis n hat. And here n hat is perpendicular to the incoming momentum. And so our little dial here on the box, when we set this dial, what we're doing is we're rotating this magnet in the, we call the direction of momentum z, we're rotating the magnet in the xy plane. So we're deciding what measurement orthogonal to the direction of momentum we're measuring along, what direction we're measuring. And then what we want to do is now say, okay, what we've done is we've correlated. Strictly speaking, we've entangled, but correlation is sufficient to understand this. We've correlated the momentum of the electron with its spin. So let's suppose that the axis n is, let's call this, let me just call this x and this will be z. We've correlated the z component of the electron, if we're in the vertical direction, the z component of the spin with the momentum along the z axis. So now what we're going to do is, to determine the spin, we're just going to measure the position of the electron. So if we find the electron in the upper half of the box, so we're just going to put a detector here. So this is called a wire chamber detector. It's very common in high-energy particle physics. The idea is that you have a charged particle here. This, what the kind of chamber is it's essentially a box filled with some gas that can be ionized by the electron charge. So as the electron passes through the gas in the box, it ionizes the gas, and then we can put, say, some voltage. These are then, these little lines are thin metallic wires, and the ionized gas will collect on the wires. And because of the voltage differential, it will create a current. So now we have something we can measure with standard electronic devices, the presence of a current. We detect a current. We detect, this is some electronics now. This is my electronic device. If we detect a current in the upper chamber, then we know the electron was found up there, and then we infer that the moment, that the spin was up along that axis. Okay, is that clear? One's kind of
Can you please repeat that again?
Which part?
Starting from the detectors.
Okay, so basically, in these high energy physics experiments, and probably more broadly than that, you often want to measure actually the precise location and momentum of a particle that's been scattered through some collision event. And so if it's a charged particle, you can create these wire chambers. And what they do is you have a wire inside of a, this is an enclosed container with some gas in it that can be ionized by the electron, by the charged particle. So if the charged particle passes through, say, this point right here in the chamber, some gas gets locally ionized. The free electrons from that ionization process collect on the wires, and then because the wires are under a voltage differential, that creates a current, and then the current then can be read out by electronics. And in fact, not only can you detect up down, but you can pinpoint the precise location. I mean, these things get quite sophisticated. If you know when the events happened for other reasons, you know the time it took and the delay for the current to appear in the detector, you can determine precisely where the charge penetrated the chamber, and all kinds of details like that. You can also put horizontal wires as well to pinpoint the coordinates. I actually helped build one of these detectors for my master's degree. So what happens then is we essentially, so okay, so that's what's happening there. That's just one, this is one of many ways to do this. And the point of this is just to show that, you know, this box is just kind of our theoretical description. And here's what's happening kind of inside the box. And so the dial, as I mentioned, determines, say, n hat.
So by changing the dial, are you rotating the magnets to change the
Yeah,
magnets?
The magnets and the detectors, actually. This entire piece of equipment would have to rotate.
So I can
this
see
is definitely a theoretician's description of how to do this, by the way.
Just out of curiosity, because I can see you being able to measure anything
yeah.
along the block sphere, but how would you do it?
Well, you would.
Okay.
So yeah, this is the full functionality measurement.
So when the, let's say, electron enters the measurement device, it still not decide whether the spin is up or down, like the it's
oh,
like
you're going there already, right?
I just wanted to like ask at which point the wave function is kind of collapsing, if it's like at the detector or if it's like at the point where it passes through the magnets.
All right, good news and bad news for you. The good news is that you're asking the right person, and the bad news is that I'm not going to answer that right now. We're going to get into that whole detail of what is measurement, when does measurement occur, and how to analyze
yeah.
that, but that's a whole lecture.
Okay.
All right? But for now, think of it as, suppose that the input, just for simplicity,
yeah, sure.
is either up or down,
cool.
and when it's a superposition, you know, something happens, and then what I'm missing in my box here is my pointer. And so I have electronics now going to my pointer, and it tells me here I only have really two outcomes, up or down, and I interpret what that means relative to the setting I've chosen, which is the idea is highlighted in the plane perpendicular to motion. Yes.
I'm kind of getting a bit ahead of myself, but I know you want to turn this thing into something which can pull the electron in and spit it out. So the idea is you could transform it and then chuck it out the other
way. Oh,
for sequential measurement at the same time. Yeah. Like, how could you do something like this in terms of an experiment where, like, you don't kind of completely destroy the electron, see those wire detectors after you've made
yes, so what you could do is you could have some aperture chambers over here. You could have, so this is my pointer. After the chambers, you could have some kind of deflectors, magnetic fields that recombine the beams.
Right.
And then you could put an exit port on here.
But don't those wire chambers kind of really, you know, like destroy the electron's path in that direction?
Well, there would be some small disturbance to the electron momentum. As it passes through the chamber, but in principle, you're correct for that.
Okay.
The point is, there's no fundamental limit to how you do this. But ultimately, we're going to deal with the issues of composite systems and entanglement here, and that does impose a fundamental limitation. In particular, what you're going to do is you're going to destroy the coherence. So, okay, you guys are forcing me to get this out of it. If the particle comes in a superposition of up and down relative to this direction n hat, then this interaction is going to, first of all, what we're doing here is we're creating an entanglement between the up state of the electron spin and its motional degree of freedom. I could actually just...
They have a homework on this, so I don't know how much you want to...
Okay, good. I don't want to leave them with the challenge. So, just to say in words then, and I'll do this more precisely later, but what's the Hilbert space here? So the Hilbert space... What Hilbert space do we need to describe this? Is that in the homework?
I mean, not so precise, but
okay.
Yeah. I mean, you can talk about it. They'll forget
it. Don't write it down. I won't remember, right? The Hilbert space here
right.
is our Hilbert space.
Yeah, they won't be in
is the two-dimensional complex vector space associated with the spin, and The spatial wave function of the electron along the n-hat direction, so L2R. And what we've done is create an entanglement between the two. And then what this does, furthermore, is creates an entanglement between the spatial degree of freedom of the electron and some internal degrees of freedom of the detector. Now, even if we recombine the beams later, we're going to do this explicitly later. So if this isn't clear, don't worry. This is just a foreshadowing or a preview. That residual entanglement is going to destroy the coherence. So even if you recombine the beams, particle went in as alpha up plus beta down. It's going to come out as a mixed state, no longer a pure state. And so you will lose the coherence. You'll exit as alpha squared projector onto up plus beta squared projector onto down. That's just a preview. We'll go through that explicitly later. But that's how decoherence leads and measurement leads to a loss of the coherence superposition. That's lovely stuff. We'll go through it in detail. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Yes.
You wrote the Hamiltonian for the interaction, but normally the Hamiltonian is S dot B, not gradient B. Did you mean force, or isn't it usually S dot B?
I think it's the gradient of B, because to get a momentum kick, you need a gradient in the magnetic field. And the gradient of the Hamiltonian is a force. But here, the Hamiltonian is given by the gradient of the magnetic field times the spin component. I'm pretty sure that's right. Does anyone want to confirm that?
Would it be the Pauli Hamiltonian?
I'm sorry?
Should it just be the Pauli Hamiltonian? Is it the S dot B? S dot B for
S dot B would cause a precession of the. If it was S dot B, the electron would go through here. This would not be a gradient. This would just be a magnetic field. And all that would happen is the momentum would be affected. The spin would just rotate in the magnetic field.
Okay.
So we need the gradient to cause the momentum kick.
Okay.
And when you say like that's the B there, it's like just the absolute value of the magnetic field. Like it's not, because you know, del, you can't take like del, which is a vector.
Yeah, it would just be the magnitude. Right.
Yeah. See how I think that's right.
Yeah, good. Okay, good stuff. All right, so let's move on to transformations. So here it's a linear operator U. It's an element of the linear operators on some Hilbert space H. Which Hilbert space you're dealing with depends on the preparation. and we have an initial condition.
Oh, I didn't do that. Okay.
Okay. So that's our postulate. Now let me unpack this a little bit. Make some remarks. Are there any handwriting issues that need to be?
Yeah, what's this a linear operator u something something h?
So this is element of.
Element of.
This is a script L, a calligraphic L, which is the set of linear operators on H. Here, let's start.
On the Hilbert space bracket. Okay.
L of H denotes linear operators. On a Hilbert space H.
And specifically not bounded, right?
It is bounded.
Okay.
It's bounded because its eigenvalue is on the unit circle.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. It's a unitary.
If u acts on H, why do you write T as the argument of u?
Well, okay, so I mean, it's one of these things where you can have multiple arguments, right? So u is parameterized by t, and for any given t, or in fact more precisely, pair of times, so give me two times t1 and t2, that defines my unitary, and now that unitary is an operator that takes vectors in the Hilbert space to vectors in the Hilbert space.
So u is a family of operators.
So u is actually, yeah, it's a
parameterized
family of operators. Actually, I guess it's, what am I missing here? I guess, If the Hamiltonian is time independent, then U is called a one parameter family because there's just one parameter. But here we're allowing the Hamiltonian to be time dependent, in which case we don't have a one parameter family of unitaries, but several parameter family of unitaries. I've never heard that expression before. So let me just write that up. So for any T1 and T2, the associated U indexed by T1 and T2 is the linear operator on the Hilbert space, which means that it takes a vector on the Hilbert space. In fact, in particular, well, that's what I wrote here. I'm just writing it now in more math notation. It takes this to some other vector in the Hilbert space. Keep up with the questions. These are great. So any other questions that, I mean, I'm going to make various comments, but if you want to just ask now, something's on your mind.
In the, sorry,
wait till the water back.
And so you can say that U is, that those use a path connected to the identity then, right?
Can you repeat that, please?
U is a path connected to the identity?
Yes, it has to be connected to identity.
If H is time dependent, does U still have this like semi-group property? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And
the composition law?
No, I think is the answer. Because it can be, I mean, H can be, if we allow discontinuous time dependence, then there's some, it's not going to be a semi-group anymore.
But don't you?
Kind of seems like it could be a,
no, I have to think about that. There's something fishy.
Yeah. We'd use a time-ordered product to define it.
We're
in a time-dependent Hamiltonian. So by definition, shouldn't the semigroup property follow from having the time ordering implemented in the series of integrals we use to define the?
Should which property follow?
Shouldn't like the semigroup property? Of, you know, you're talking about the composition.
Yeah. In what sense do we use time ordering?
Use the time
if you want to write U explicitly,
yeah,
in terms of
in
H.
In terms of H.
Look, traditionally, okay, here's the thing, the subtlety I'm worried about is traditionally a semigroup is defined in terms of a continuity assumption. And I'm worried about, it's not clear to me if the Hamiltonian has arbitrary time dependence, if the induced unitary always satisfies that continuity assumption.
Right, but the composition...
Maybe it does, but I don't know.
At the very least, the composition law seems like it would still work, I guess, would it?
Yeah.
And often, here's the other problem, is that if I'm remembering correctly, a semigroup is usually defined in terms of a one-parameter family.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the same statement. I was trying to just maybe be a bit more concrete about what you meant
by
the fact that it's...
These are pretty subtle issues, so maybe we should set them aside for now, but
okay.
I agree that there's some interesting questions there.
Yeah, sure.
Is there any explicit reason why EU doesn't get hats somewhere?
You know, I just drop the hats because I forget them.
Okay.
Often they're implicit, right? So
yeah, sure.
Assume everything's an operator. Some of your operators can be called numbers.
All right. Good stuff. Thanks for the questions. Okay, so what else do we want to say? Okay, so notice that we didn't stipulate that U was unitary, and this is a good exercise for the students. You could maybe you have it already, but you can prove that any linear operator satisfying this equation subject to this initial condition is a unitary operator.
I think you want H to be self-adjoint for that to be true.
Yes.
I presume because it's a Hamiltonian.
Correct. I mean, perhaps redundant, but definitely correct. Thank you. So this implies that U is unitary, which means that U dagger U is equal to U, U dagger is equal to the identity operator. Okay, so if H has explicit time dependence, then we can write down a general solution. Where T denotes time ordering, right to left, time order. Have some of you not seen this explicitly yet? If so, I can give an example. Who would like an example? Some of you, great. Let me start the example over here. Okay, so now we have a Hamiltonian for the Pauli spin operators Z and X. These are just the spin operators I defined earlier, but with H bar over 2 is removed. In fact, we've absorbed. Imagine what this Hamiltonian comes from is we have now, someone asked earlier about what happens without the gradient. So imagine we have a magnetic field along the Z-axis. That magnetic field couples to the spin component by a coupling constant. It's described by nature. We're just absorbing the magnitude of the field, coupling constant, and the h bar over 2 all into this coefficient, similarly for x. And they're time dependent. So the time dependence corresponds to the fact that we're allowing, there's some grad student in the lab that can flip a switch and that turns on and off the z field, and turns on and off the x field. Okay, so theta of t represents time-dependent magnetic fields. And other constants. Are absorbed into it, just for simplicity. Okay, now let's further, let's prescribe, let's prescribe a particular time dependence. Okay, so let's suppose that from, from T1 equals 0 to T2 equals tau, we have beta z is equal to theta, and beta x is equal to 0. And let me fix this. Let me call this T2 over 2. Okay. Then from, just to be consistent with my notation, then from T2 over 2 equals tau to T2 equals 2 tau. Sorry about this. Probably a better way to parameterize this. So we have a time period tau, which is half of our interval T1 to T2, during which the z field is on and the x field is off. And then subsequently, from the second half of our time interval, T1 to T2, which is also the same duration tau, we have the z field is off and the x field is on. And let's just make it the same magnitude.
That T2 over 2 equals tau and T2 equals 2 tau, isn't that the same instant of time?
Yes, it's the same instant of time. Fortunately, nothing happens during an instant. So strictly speaking, you're right. This should be like greater than tau, right? Let's be careful. Okay. So now recall that a Hamiltonian of the form H equals theta sigma n reduces what's called precession about the n-axis. or rotation, actually. I'm not 100% sure that I'm using the word precession correctly here, although I should know this since I did a post about it in the morning. It's a rotation of the spin about the axis, which may or may not also be called precession. And about the n-hat axis, so in particular, let me just call this h-naught, okay? Then in particular, we have u is equal to e to the minus I beta sigma n over h bar for whatever duration of time we're dealing with, tau over 2.
I meant that will be t2 over 2 equals 2 tau.
Not 2, it's tau, sorry. So this is duration for duration tau. I'm sorry, can you repeat your point?
I just meant that that would be just t2 over 2 equals theta, 2 tau.
T2 over 2 equals tau?
And t2 over...
Same thing.
I mean, you need a time duration of tau, right?
We need a time duration of tau for the first period and a time duration of tau for the second period.
Yes, yeah, so that would just be...
The same t2, you want to also choose a different t, right?
Well, that's
t3. No, it's not. I mean, the point is... Look, here's time.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I'm screwing this up, but just close, walk through it, okay? Here's my time t1, here's my time t2, here's halfway between them.
Yeah.
T2 minus t1 over 2 is what I mean. Ah, right. So, oh, I know, I said t1 equals 0. Perfect. All right, so that's great. So this is 0. So then this is t2 over 2. All right? Good so far? And now I'm calling this period tau. I'm calling this period tau. Doing good so far?
Okay.
Now this is just for any one of those two periods tau. We have this form. Now what's missing? Is this correct?
Yeah, I mean, if you write them as a label, it's correct. I mean, you are kind of equating the very, I mean, T2, the label T2. To
is
both,
it,
to just
t2
tau.
You multiply by 2 on both sides, it looks like something's happening.
In the
okay,
last
you know
line.
What? I'm just going to keep going. I do not see what the problem is, and maybe it'll become clear to me in a moment. If it's not clear to you guys, just start hollering.
No.
Alright? So then, okay, so now. Then our time-ordered exponential would then be the following. It's right to left. So remember that u, we're going to write that up here. U is acting on the state, right? So it's a left multiplication, which means that the first thing that happens, it's going to happen on the right side, the right-hand side. So the first thing that happens is our z field is on, our x field is off. And then the second thing that happens is that the x field is on. So I'll write the second thing first. So we have this, we have the following. We have minus I beta x sigma x for a time duration tau divided by h bar. And then prior to that, which is on the right hand side, we have the action of the z field first for a time period tau over h bar. That's the final answer. Now, is there anything funny about the notation still, or are we okay?
I think there's only the problem that the tau is defined as t2 equals 2 tau.
Oh.
But, and that's basically all those three things that are written over there say the same thing. So basically, I think you want to say that from T half bigger than tau, or like, you know.
Oh, here's what I can just hear. Let's do this. I think I see what's going on now.
Yeah.
Define tau as T2 over 2 minus T1. We good?
Yeah.
That's what I want?
Yeah.
And then from T2 over 2 to T2.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right, thank you. I love precision. So this is great. All right, so the notation aside, which was a little bit clumsy, I apologize. Are we good with this? Any questions about what's happening here? So this is how to interpret the time order, operator. We're good? Okay, now I'm continuing. Okay, remarks on postulate 2, on postulate 3. Continue. Things are much simpler if H is time independent. Then we have a very simple form, which is just u for some time t is equal to minus I h times t over h bar. And more importantly, we recover what you're used to, which is the Schrodinger equation. And this, of course, so the Schrodinger equation is implied by the form of our postulate. I think it's Schrodinger, if your pronunciation right. Which you all know, but I'll write it down anyways. Implies it in either case, right? But with an H would be. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it probably does, but it's not obvious to me how to show that.
Well, it's just that equation that you wrote already, if you plug in psi.
So for time-dependent case,
like see that in the middle board, the thing you started with, your postulate. If you evaluate that on the psi, right?
Yeah.
That's the time-dependent. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Right. So let me just say. Let me just make this a separate one. Postulate 3 implies this. Thank you. Okay, that's the way it is in my notes. Great. Sorry, I was working from a. This is correct. Yes.
It's not clear to me why postulate 3 implies the Schrodinger equation. Why can't you just plug psi into there? Like, you and psi live in different spaces, right?
Oh, you can't just do that.
Oh, okay.
So I should have.
So how does it imply
you actually lie? Well, look, here, we in the postulate, we established that relationship. So now what you want to do is take the left-hand side, psi of t2, just take its derivative, partial derivative with respect to t2, and then use the chain rule on the right-hand side. Actually, what would we need the chain rule? The derivative only acts upon the u part. And then you substitute this equation, and this would be a great exercise for the tutorial. You substitute this equation into there, and you'll recover Schrodinger's equation. And then it's crystal clear that this works for arbitrary time-dependent households. Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. That was a good point. Okay, any other questions? All right, let me erase.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
When you, in the board where you have postulate three, I don't quite understand the setup. Do you want to say that remark? Is that a definition, the first remark on that board?
Yeah, denote means definition.
Okay.
LH is this notation for the set of linear operators on the board.
So, or I rather, the second remark.
That's just a clarification of someone has asked. Yeah, this is redundant. So someone asked, how come I put T as an argument of the unitary when the unitary is a linear operator, and so its argument should be a vector in the Hilbert space?
Is psi of T2 defined as U times psi of T1?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's plug in.
So if you take the equation under postulate 3 and just act it on psi of t1 on both sides, do you not get the Schrodinger equation directly?
Take this?
Yeah.
Well, instead of my... Well, you have to get a derivative of psi of t2 at some point. So here, this derivative is only acting on this guy. So how are you going to get it? You have to get an expression of psi by dt acting on psi t2, right?
That would work.
You have to get this piece. I don't know how you get that piece.
You can act on psi t1.
Yeah.
How do you?
So that equation, the meaning of that, like when you write the derivative of u, like when you differentiate this operator, what is the output as an object? It's not so clear. So like the interpretation of that equation is that if you put in front of u any psi at time t1, and then you, like in both of those sides, right? Then you differentiate u t1.
Well, the partial of the operator is well.
Right, but
well, and here's how you define it. This is a very good question, and I'll tell you how to define it. This is something you should all know.
But it's,
so it's in terms of the spec of decomposition. So what does it mean to have a function of an operator or a derivative of an operator, right? So we can define the partial of some operator via the spectral decomposition. Okay, so U is self-adjoint. Is that obvious? Well, unitary, therefore, it's self-adjoint. So then we U for A, U is parameterized by these two parameters. And we can write down the spectral decomposition.
It's not. If it's unitary, it's adjoint equals its inverse, not itself.
Oh, sorry. It is. It has a spectral decomposition, but it's not self-adjoint. Thank you. How do we know that?
Because it's like the exponential of some condition.
If you want to define differentiation in the strong topology, which means that if you act on, like, the strong topology is just if you act on things, then it does what you want, right? Like. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah,
like
it's defined by its action on the space.
On the actual space. That's
right.
What like the strong topology means. Like something converges if for any like psi, the sequence converges.
Yeah.
So in the strong topology, the statement that you made, the correct way of interpreting it, is that u at t2, t1 for any psi if you differentiate that with respect to T2, like that'll be something in your Hilbert space, and you differentiate that with respect to T2, then you'll get the right-hand side acting on psi.
Okay.
Which is precisely the Schrodinger equation.
Okay, so you're saying that if you unpack this in that sense,
in
then
this,
it actually
yeah.
is equivalent.
That's literally the Schrodinger equation. Yeah.
But
that's
we
it.
Also
so it doesn't apply, but it also
it is
implied by
the same
no,
thing.
But also,
yeah.
We also need the initial condition. If we use the initial condition that u times 0 is just 1, that
yes.
u 0, 0 is, one, it is the identity, then I think that it'd be very simple to take psi of 0 and then see that we get the Schrodinger equation. And then, because we don't have to worry about the time derivative hitting the other, the hitting side. But what he said is obviously that he's straightforward. But if you took u of t 2 comma 0 and then use these two equations, then we'll definitely get the Schrodinger equation at arbitrary times.
Okay, so I mean, to summarize, you can use this equation to deduce the Schrodinger equation, as I suggested, or as, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Dylan.
As Dylan suggested, if we interpret this partial derivative in terms of the strong topology, then the two are actually equivalent. So that I have not seen before, so that's very interesting.
So Dylan, are you actually saying that if you the derivative of time of the operator acting on a vector is the same as the operator acting on the vector and then differentiate the whole thing by with respect to time? So I know it's true, but
so
I mean, you're just
yeah.
kind of like asserting it.
So it's a matter of like what you mean when you differentiate, right?
Right.
If you want to do differentiation, you need a notion of like limits, right?
Yep.
And like norms.
Yep.
So I think if you take strong topology and operator norm, then unpack that statement.
I mean, I know you can't.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it has to be right, otherwise,
yeah.
it wouldn't be equivalent. But it's not.
Yeah.
I'm sure it follows immediately.
Yeah. These probably aren't details that we should really, like, we should take it as meaning if you put in any psi, then the statement's true.
In fact, I almost want to say that because it's only because H is unitary that you can do it.
Pardon me?
I almost want to say that it's only because H is unitary that you can do
this. This is not
good. I can't
because
hear you, but I feel like this is too much of an aside.
Yeah,
just let him go ahead.
So in addition to the Schrodinger picture, many of you have probably seen, you can describe dynamics also in the Heisenberg picture. I won't go into too much detail since this is in the tutorial. Is we allow the observables to acquire time dependence. Leads to the same predictions once you put it inside the Born rule, as perhaps you will see later in the tutorial. And I want you to contrast this with time evolution in the Schrodinger picture. Or projectors. Which is just now, instead of dealing with the Hilbert space vector, we're going to get rid of the extra phase freedom by looking at the projectors. So then we have psi at time t2 is equal to U. Psi at time T1. Index. Okay, so the key point here is that here we're evolving. In this picture, the states have no time dependence, but the operators require time dependence. In the Schrodinger picture, the operators have no time dependence except for any explicit time dependence you put on them, but they have no dynamical time dependence, and only the states have dynamical time dependence. The key thing to remember, and you can check for consistency by checking that the Born rule is the same, the dagger, the adjoint, is on the left-hand side for the Heisenberg picture, and it's on the right-hand side for the Schrodinger picture. Oh, okay. I think that's it for postulate three for now. What I was going to launch into next is composite systems, which should be fairly new for most of you. So I think probably there's not much point in doing it with 5 minutes left, so maybe we'll end a bit early. But before we do so, are there any questions?
What's AH here? Is that an operator?
So yeah, AH is an observable. And the subscript. H stands for Heisenberg. It's a reminder that we're in the Heisenberg picture. So the time depends on the equation. The time that A has time dependence. Due to the unitary. Anything else? Yeah.
We assume that U evaluated at the same time is equal to the identity only for one specific time. How do you show that that is true?
You'll do it today.
We'll do it this afternoon. Oh, we'll do it, okay.
Thanks. Okay, great. Well, I guess I'll see you tomorrow then. Thanks for your attention.